Europe is a very small stage.
I think it's much more interesting to live not knowing than have answers which might be wrong.
It's not really about going to another star system. It's about how do we improve life here on Earth?
Not only the question, but the way you try to solve it.
Beauty at this dimension, 1 centimeter, is also beauty at a smaller dimension.
Hello and good evening. You're listening to UBC Sharing Science Radio, broadcasting from CITR 101.9 FM on unceded Musqueam territory at the University of British Columbia. Sharing Science Radio is here to bring you a weekly dose of science news, discussion, interviews, and local events. I'm your host, Rohit Singla, and tonight with me are Sam Livingston and Tanya Rusi. By now, we've all seen those amazing photos of Pluto and that beautiful surface that we all, you know, did not know about before. But really, what do you know about your own planet Earth? I mean, we're all living on a beautiful blue marble floating out there in space, but how much about it do you really know? So tonight, we're going into the Earth with a few different segments talking about the electromagnetic radiation, the electromagnetic field, the Earth's core, and even some dinosaur topics here. How's about we get started with that, though? Sam, do you want to start us off?
You got it, Rohit. The outer core of the Earth is proposed to be a molten mass of iron that is of high temperature, high pressure, and high density. Since it is believed to be liquid, these heavy metals flow within the outer core because of a difference in heat between the boundaries of the inner core, which is 6,000 degrees Celsius, and the mantle, which is 3,800 degrees Celsius. This flow is considered to be the source of Earth's magnetic field, which results in the magnetic north and south poles on Earth. For our everyday lives, humans are often unconcerned about the magnetic field of Earth, besides our seldom use of a compass for reorienting ourselves on a hike. For geologists and scientists studying the formation of planetary bodies in our early universe, the geomagnetic field has much more to offer us. One observation by geologists that provided us evidence that a magnetic field is present on Earth is the orientation of polar compounds, meaning tiny molecules that also have a positive and negative end like we see on magnets, aligning themselves in the fossil record in a uniform direction. However, a wrench was thrown into this theory in the early 1900s when lava flows in Japan, observed by Motonori Matsuyama, appeared to have polar compounds oriented in the opposite direction than we would expect with the current state of Earth's magnetic field. This was the first strong evidence of geomagnetic reversals, where the North and South poles switch their positions on Earth. Scientists are now aware that this has happened with a certain amount of regularity. Reversals tend to occur once every 100,000 to 1 million years, with the last one having happened nearly 800,000 years ago. That means that another geomagnetic reversal is in the pipeline for Earth, and though it is not an event that happens overnight, usually taking about 5,000 years, shorter reversal times have occurred, which a study published in October of 2014 found that the most recent full reversal happened in 100 years. During the transition period of a reversal, compasses would not be reliable, but scientists warn of much greater consequences to our lives if we were to experience such a reversal period. That is, if humans are still around by that point. Stay tuned to hear more about why magnetic fields are so important to our daily lives.
All right, thanks, Sam. What about you, Tanya? What do you have?
Well, Rohit, in the distant past, the Earth was flat, or so it seemed. People around the world, from Europe to China and ancient America, envisioned our world in all sorts of peculiar flat geometries. But this concept did not prevail for as long as you may think. In the 6th century BC, Pythagoras wrote about a spherical Earth. 3 centuries later, Eratosthenes was able to calculate the circumference of the Earth with incredible accuracy. He was only a few percent off of the actual number. By the 1st century AD, Ptolemy compiled the geographical knowledge of the time and wrote the definitive book of the time, simply titled Geography. The book was such a standard reference that Columbus himself owned a copy. Since we have considered the Earth as a sphere, we have wondered what it was made of. The inside of the Earth was thought of as fiery, frozen, or even hollow. In the 19th century, explorers thought they might find portals at the North Pole, which could lead to the empty core. It wasn't until the 1930s that we had a good idea of what was below the Earth's crust, and that was thanks in part to a progressive school and schoolmistress in Denmark. Inge Lehmann was born in Denmark in 1888. She went to a progressive school where girls were treated exactly like boys, and where class did not matter. It is going to this school that potentially led this scientist to believe and feel like she could be a scientist in a time where women were not considered appropriate for science. The school is run by Hannah Adler, an aunt of Niels Bohr. In the absence of prejudice, Lehmann was able to flourish as a young intellectual, and she went on to study mathematics at Copenhagen University and then at Newnham College in Cambridge. Her inevitable encounters with prejudice after leaving the progressive school hardly slowed her down. She became an assistant to a geodesist professor in 1925. She set up seismograph stations in several locations and taught herself seismology in her spare time. At the time, scientists believed the core of the Earth was liquid. Earthquakes were the primary tool scientists used to study the core, watching how waves from earthquakes moved through the Earth and bounced around. Lehmann used the data from her stations, carefully recorded and organized on cardboard cards in cardboard oatmeal boxes, to show that this theory wasn't right. By meticulously analyzing seismograph data, in particular the transmission of P waves through the Earth, she showed that the inner core was solid, in essence discovering the core of the Earth. Her article on the result was simply titled P Prime and is a classic in the literature today.
All right. So Tanya's got P Woman, Sam's got Broken Compasses, and I've got, you know, something cool. I've got dinosaurs, guys. So we've all heard about dinosaurs. They're these creatures that ruled the planet Earth millions of years ago in the Mesozoic era. They reigned for nearly 200 million years. That's more time it takes than for me to write an exam. Where they ate, slept, and lived pretty much like any other wild animal that we know of today. But that's just it. How do we even know that they existed? Neither you, nor I, or any human being alive today was alive back then, in the Mesozoic era. No human could observe or study these animals directly. Or a lot of other creatures, actually. There are millions of species that don't live today that we know about now. In fact, only a small fraction of species alive today make up all the species that have ever existed. So, how do we know about these creatures? It starts with fossilization. Fossilization, beyond the process of making fossils, is where you replace the bits that are organic in an animal, animal remains, with minerals instead. The result of this is, well, a fossil, obviously, and that's our key. Scientists use fossils as evidence of life that existed previously. They can tell us about the climate, the weather, the timeline of when creatures lived and died. They help us understand species and evolution and where creatures fit in the grand puzzle that is life. From an evolutionary and anthropological standpoint, what lies in the earth is invaluable information. That's why, when a new fossil was discovered in Ecuador last month, it helped put another piece of our history together. Lucy, known as the only ancestor of modern humans, was discovered to actually have a relative. The discovery of jaw bones disillusioned us from thinking Lucy was alone, and gives researchers hope that they're on their way to discovering the next piece of the puzzle. What will the next fossil tell us? How will it impact what we know about ourselves? Will it tell us we were feathered at one point, much like the dinosaurs are? Or something even more drastic, something even more exciting? What lies in our own planet Earth? Anyways, we'll let you think about that. In the meantime, we're going to take a quick break, and when we're back, we're going to break all these stories down. Stay tuned.
Are you looking for a volunteer opportunity that fits your schedule? Being a big sister takes less time than you think, and you can choose the volunteer opportunity that fits your life. Spend just 1 hour a week as a study buddy, tutor, or 2 hours a week as a big sister. Check out the various mentoring programs at Big Sisters of BC Lower Mainland and find a volunteer position and a little sister that will suit you to a T. Visit bigsisters.bc.ca for more information today.
Welcome back. You're listening to UBC Sharing Science Radio. So, Tanya, the Earth's not flat, you're telling me?
That's right, Rohit. I think one of the most common misconceptions is that Columbus discovered that the Earth wasn't flat when he sailed to the Americas.
But he didn't?
No, he didn't at all. In fact, he owned a textbook that was all about the Earth being round, written in the first century AD. The concept of the Earth as round went back to the 6th century BC. But after the Dark Ages, as we were moving into the Enlightenment, there was some pretty strong feelings about rationalism versus spiritualism, let's say.
Okay.
So evidence-based findings instead of belief.
That's right. And unfortunately, the guys on the evidence-based side weren't always good actors.
Fair. Okay, so it sounds like we're talking about the middle, like old century internet style here, where two people are just debating things. And really, Columbus got away with the textbook.
No, what happened was Columbus knew the Earth was round, but as we were moving into the age of rationalism, a historian wrote a book about Columbus discovering the Americas where he painted the people of the time, particularly the religious people, as believing the Earth is flat. And this was basically a big fat lie.
Mm. Not bad. Not bad.
Most educated people believed that the Earth was round for long before the Middle Ages and the Dark Ages. Okay. What that guy did could be construed as slander or libel.
So before that was found out, how would the general population know that the Earth was round?
Well, the concept of the round Earth has been around since the 6th century BC, like I said before, and the radius had even been calculated to a couple percents of its actual value since, like, I think 98 AD.
Okay.
There's a number of reasons why we would believe that the Earth was round just based on observation. Like, if you see a ship on the horizon, the bottom of the ship is obscured because the Earth is curving. There's right. a number of things like that. The shadow of the Earth on the moon is round. It doesn't come square or straight like an edge. And that was always a good indication.
Okay. So it's interesting you mentioned the radius. So we calculated this radius long before we discovered the core of the Earth was solid. Like, wouldn't people have some idea it was solid before our discovery? Or how do you go about measuring and determining that the Earth's core is actually solid?
Yeah, that's a super good question. So we did know that the Earth was round based on pretty simple observations, but what we didn't know was what was inside the Earth. A lot of the early geological studies had to do with what was on the surface of the Earth, the rocks and the fossils and the formations like volcanoes and mountains and so on.
Right.
But what was inside the Earth was still pretty much left up to the storytellers. The Norse people thought that the inside of the Earth was icy and cold. The Greeks thought of it as a fiery hell, Hades. And in the 19th century, the idea of it as being hollow was really popular. In fact, a bunch of explorers wanted to go to the North Pole, where they thought that they would find portals into the center of the hollow Earth.
Wait, there aren't portals? What?
No. Uh-huh. There was some science that indicated that the Earth would be solid before this time. And once seismography was invented, scientists were able to study how earthquake waves traveled through the Earth to figure out what was inside. Like, did they bounce off things, reflect off things, go straight through? Did they slow down or speed up?
Interesting. Okay, but are waves really the only way you could do this? Like, what other techniques could she have done?
Well, there's a lot of techniques available, but using P waves and S waves from earthquakes was and still is one of the most popular ways to study the center of the Earth. In fact, just recently, scientists used the transmission of P and S waves to discover that the Earth's core has a core.
Wait, what?
Yeah, there's an even harder core inside of the core.
Oh, that's hardcore.
This is like some Inception-level stuff up here.
So another thing we've tried to do, and this was in the Cold War during the space race, one direction was out towards the stars, but another direction was in towards the core. Both the U.S. and the USSR started massive drilling projects in an attempt to pierce the mantle and get a sample of the liquid.
And I'm pretty sure most of the drilling wells that are happening in eastern Serbia, I think those are the furthest into the Earth's crust that they've ever gotten, which was about 12,000 kilometers.
Yeah, that's right. That was the USSR's project as part of the race against the USA. The USA started their project and then killed it about 4 years later due to a lack of funding and unhappiness with the results, even though they actually did achieve their goal in phase one of the project. The Soviets were more tenacious and hung on for, I think, 30-some-odd years, digging deeper and deeper into the mantle of the Earth. What eventually happened in 1994 was they got so deep that the rock was so hot, it was about 180 degrees Celsius, that it basically acted like a plastic, like a kind of semi-liquid, gooey rock. And
yummy.
Every time they would drill in and it was time to change the drill bit, they'd pull their drill out and it would just flow back together and close up the hole.
That's disgusting.
That must have been pretty exciting, though, being able to see, like, this is the closest that someone's ever been to the inside of the mantle. Everything that you're using to get in is just melting away. That must have been, like, right on the precipice of being able to see what's beneath the crust.
Yeah, yeah. Sam, I'm not sure if these guys had scientific discovery on the mind when they were drilling here.
They actually did. They made a ton of really important discoveries with this drilling project. They found fossils. They found bacteria living deep in the earth. They found all sorts of things that are a huge part of geoscience today. It pumped out discoveries for the whole 36 years that it ran.
Very cool. Talking about all these cores, I wonder, Sam, does a core have any impact on the geomagnetic field or any influence there?
Absolutely, and I'm pretty sure the scientists have agreed that it's the outer core of the Earth that is actually that results in the geomagnetic field. And since when I was talking about the introduction before, since these hot metals are moving so quickly and at such a high pace, that the metals themselves, they create a field that extends out into our atmosphere and even out into space that's outside of what we consider our normal atmosphere. And you can think of Earth as a magnet, and obviously we have our north and south poles, but when we're talking about the geomagnetic field, it's the magnetic north pole and the magnetic south pole. And they differ because they're on a little bit of a tilted axis from what we know as the Arctic Circle, being the north and the south.
Interesting. Okay, so it's not quite, you know, what you and I imagine it to be. They're a little bit off, eh?
Yeah, just a little bit.
Okay, so talking about these magnetic fields, Sam, what happens during a reversal? Like, why should I care?
Well, since I mentioned that reversals happen quite often in the history of the Earth, and as they go through these periods of reversing back and forth, and now we have a state where north is where our North Pole actually is, in the process they become weaker and weaker as the magnetic field itself breaks down slightly and tries to reverse itself. And I think this has a lot to do with the actual flow within the outer core, because right now when we're at a stable state of having a north and a south pole, then they're in a very constant flow and a regular pattern. But then I'm not sure what causes it to change, but slowly the flow becomes irregular, which then creates a bunch of smaller north and south poles that have a very, very, very weak force compared to our normal dipole of having a north and a big north and a big south.
So I guess having these weak fields and this weaker overall result kind of affects what radiation we get shielded from then, eh?
Absolutely, yeah. There's something called the solar coronas, and these are big emissions from our sun that extend out into the universe. So these coronal mass ejections, and they are very high energy, and our magnetic field is actually able to protect us slightly from this. So since right now we have a relatively strong magnetic field on Earth, we're being semi-protected from these solar mass ejections. But as the reversal begins and the magnetic field of Earth begins to weaken, we're less and less protected from these ejections, and that gives us more holes in the ozone layer, and that makes us far more likely to have skin cancers and be at risk of radiation damage.
But another question for you, Sam. All right, so we're talking about these EM fields, I'll call them, magnetic fields, you know, EM for short.
You said magnetic fields are EM for short? What do you mean by that?
You know what, Tanya? I actually don't know what I meant by that.
Oh, well, why don't I help you out?
Please do.
Electromagnetic fields.
Oh.
Because electric fields and magnetic fields are actually inextricably tied. A change in an electric field creates a changing magnetic field, and a changing magnetic field creates a changing electric field. That's what we see as light. That's what X-rays are, and gamma rays, and even infrared radiation.
Right. It's all part of that
electromagnetic spectrum.
Yeah. Jinx. Okay. So my bad. Yes. EM fields are the same as magnetic fields. But you've been saying these reversals have happened over years, right? Would previous humans like Neanderthals be affected?
Definitely. And I think there was a study in 2014 that talked about how one of these more recent reversals, I think it may be the one that was 800,000 years ago, that may be a direct link towards why there was a demise in the Neanderthals all of a sudden. And I'm not sure if there's the fossil record and evolution of humans can back this up. But it seems like the Neanderthals were doing just fine on Earth, and then all of a sudden there was like some catastrophic event that happened in a very short period of time where Neanderthals all of a sudden were just gone from the record.
Oh, maybe without working compasses, all their self-driving cars crashed.
Huh.
Anyways.
No GPS on those things.
Yeah, poor Neanderthals. Speaking of the fossil record, who's Lucy?
So Lucy, otherwise known as
Australopithecus?
Yeah. Let's go with that. That sounds better. Was actually considered, her species at least, to be the only ancestor of modern humans. That means if you looked at one of those fancy phylogenetic trees, and you went all the way back, you would at one point see Lucy as the sole node for all of mankind, humankind. And so that's Lucy. Why is she important, however, is that by saying we've discovered her cousin, we've actually expanded this tree. That's a significant diversion from what we've previously known.
Do you mean that the tree has two trunks now?
So the tree of life, as you can think of it.
The human life tree.
Human life.
Okay.
Is a phylogenetic tree. And it's a tool that scientists and researchers use to help us map out evolution. When species diverged in traits, when new species evolved and appeared over time. It helps us kind of map out, you know, what really makes a bird different from another type of bird, or what makes all these different types of humans, Homo sapiens, Neanderthals, all their cousins in between, the same and the different, and helps us sort that out. So when we say Lucy has a cousin and that we've added another node to the tree, our tree now actually potentially can diverge. And so where there previously would be one trunk, it would now split off into two, or perhaps three, or perhaps four, or perhaps as many as we can figure out, depending on what we discover with the fossil record.
This kind of reminds me, though, like, that should have been obvious, shouldn't it? The fact that there could have been more than one trunk. Did we have to discover it for that to become possible? It kind of reminds me of exoplanets. Like, my science teacher in grade 6 taught me that there was only the planets around the sun because we hadn't discovered any. And
right.
I thought that was dumb. Like, of course there would be more planets. Just because we haven't discovered any doesn't mean it's not possible.
We can hypothesize and we can make these assumptions. So you're right. It's possible that Lucy would have been not the sole ancestor of modern humans. But really, we didn't have any evidence to back that up. And now we do. And that's the exciting part. Is that all that we think is true in reality, all this mess that is known as the human life, we actually have evidence to back that up. And that's kind of the fundamental part of science and discovering things. What did you say, Sam?
Yeah, the fossil record is really cool. And you get to see a lot of the transitions between different species. For example, I think it was back in the early 1900s that they found one of the key components for evidence of evolution. And that's the Archaeopteryx fossil.
What?
Archaeopteryx.
All right, I'm not going to say that, but go ahead, Sam.
It kind of sounds like a dinosaur, right?
It sounds like a delicious dinosaur.
Well, that's what's interesting about this, is that it's not quite a dinosaur, but it's not quite a bird as well.
Oh.
This was a perfect snapshot of the transition between reptiles and dinosaurs and their transition into birds. So this was a feathered animal that was cold-blooded, and it appeared like it could fly for maybe a couple feet up into the air, but it wasn't able to completely fly. So it was a transition period where I'd also like to point out that most dinosaurs were feathered, and I think that's a misconception in the Jurassic world.
If you're listening at home, I'd like you to imagine my face, except extremely shocked and confused by what Sam's saying. He's telling me that the creatures in The Land Before Time were not accurate.
At least many of them were feathered, if not most of them, I'm pretty sure.
Okay.
I think that's one of the common misconceptions about what dinosaurs were in their time.
Okay. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
But, Sam, you're a biologist. What's the deal with species? How do we tell that, you know, this dinosaur is one species, this fossil is another species? You know, even Homo sapiens versus different types of Homo sapiens, or I don't know. How do you tell species apart?
That's a loaded question, Rohit. So there are many different ways that you can classify a biological organism as a species. They can be reproductively isolated, meaning that when the male and female of the whatever individuals that we're talking about, if they're able to reproduce and produce offspring that can live and also reproduce, then some biologists might consider that a single species.
Okay.
And even if they were two completely different looking, it doesn't matter what they looked like, and it didn't matter how far away in the evolutionary tree they were, if they're able to reproduce, then they're the same species.
Okay.
Then there's a morphological definition of species, where if they look so distant and so different from one another, then they must be different species. It doesn't matter if they're able to reproduce or not.
Like a lion and a tiger?
Yes, and as we all know, the liger is a beautiful animal.
It's my favorite.
Yes. Anyways, I digress about the definition of a species, because that's a topic for another day.
But that's pretty cool. It sounds like we've got biological, morphological. Are there any other ways we can kind of define species? Perhaps ecology? Sam's awkward pause is the answer, yes. You can actually... Part of it is an ecological species concept, where depending on species niches, their mating patterns, the food they eat, that is also another tool that researchers use to define species. I'm not sure if it's as common. I kind of only briefly remember it. But compared to phylogenetic, which is evolution, morphological, which is comparing species, how they appear, and biological, kind of those three or four concepts pretty much break it down in how scientists classify a species from another.
I'm willing to bet that in the future we just use a genetic classification scheme.
I think eventually we will, but there are some limitations to that, though. Because I think there are some different organisms that have very different genetics, such as the lion and the tiger, and they're still able to reproduce. So, and again, this is talking from one biologist's perspective of what a species is.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, there's so many different ways that you could call a species that it's going to be impossible to, unless everybody agreed on one single term, which for hundreds of years apparently is not a thing. But you're right, for fossils it's kind of hard to define what a species is, as if there wasn't already enough problems trying to figure out whether one organism is a species or not.
Okay, so like, what do we do then, Sam?
We'd probably have to use strictly the morphological definition of a species. And they have used this in a number of different cases to figure out some really weird anomalies. For example, let's take whales. Back in the 1900s, you'd see them swimming around in the ocean, and they're similar to dolphins, and they're similar to other fish, they're similar to sharks.
But
they are mammals.
What?
They are not fish, they are mammals. They are more closely related to humans than they are to fish. And one of the tip-offs for evolutionary biologists that were first looking at the skeletal remains of whales was in the middle ear. And those are the three bones that we know of from our biology 10 courses, where we've got the hammer, the stirrups, and
the anvil.
Anvil, yes.
Yeah, that's right, Daniel.
That's the one.
I learned that one time in biology 10.
It's weird how we retain some of these little tiny nitpicks of facts, but not other topics.
So you're telling me that because we humans and they, whales, have similar ear structure that we're related?
Well, if you think about it, every single organism on Earth is related to one another because there is what's called the last common ancestor.
Okay.
And the last universal common ancestor was what gave rise to all life as we know it on Earth right now.
Interesting. Okay.
That's so cool.
So if I go back farther enough, I can find common ancestors between myself and any other species, ideally?
All evidence right now points towards one single origin of species. And that is its name is Luca, very similar to Lucy. That's what I thought you were talking about when I first was reading through your story, actually. And Luca is, we don't know what Luca was like, because all we know is that it was the only surviving organism that has given rise to all life that currently exists right now.
But so, why don't we think that there's more than one species?
You know what? Luca's a fascinating topic that we'll actually be talking about next week here on Sharing Science Radio. In the meantime, however, that's all the time we have for tonight's show. Thanks to Sam and Tanya for joining me tonight, and thank you for listening in. Tune in next Wednesday at 6 p.m., and stick around to hear music from our friends over at Interspace with Christian and Daniel. Later days.